Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Well, today we go from our jazz introduction to another kind of music, the blues. We're going to be talking about the famous blues singer and guitarist and composer and performer Lead Belly, played the 12-string guitar, and a book came out last year, a book of poetry, a collection of some wonderful poems by a professor now at the University of Illinois. We're happy to have as our guest in the studio today, Tahimba Jess. Welcome.
It's good to be here.
Now, how did you get interested in writing about Lead Belly?
Well, Lead Belly had a fascinating career. He was born in the mid-1880s around the Shreveport, Louisiana area. He died in 1949 in Harlem, New York. Along the way, he knew about 500 songs off the top of his head. He was considered the king of the 12-string guitar. And he also had many troubles with the law. He went to prison twice, once for murder, once for essentially attempted murder. But he was able to find a way through his music and through his art to overcome himself, as well as the barriers that he found both through race, class, and predicament.
How did you first hear of his life and his music?
Well, I love the blues a lot. You know, I've listened to the blues for a long time, although Lead Belly isn't particularly, he's more of a folk musician than a blues musician. His story seems to be such a part of the blues, the understanding of the blues. You know, his story seems to lend itself so well to the story of the blues. That's one way that I got introduced to him, is through reading his biography, and his reading whatever I could find about him, and doing research about him. His life just got more and more fascinating. And the other thing is that in dealing with his story, I found how his history echoed throughout, you know, the 20th century and out throughout American history. So many of the predicaments that Lead Belly found himself in, I see echoed today, particularly in the relationship, African-American relationship with the prison industrial complex, relationship with the recording industry, relationship to anthropology, et cetera. So it just seemed, and also, you know, relationship between men and women. So it seemed something that just, his story just initially fascinated me because, as I said, he went to jail twice, and he did sing his way out of prison on one occasion when he was able to.
The governor actually.
Yeah, the governor of Texas actually came down to the prison that he was in, and he would have the convicts play for him, and on one occasion, Lead Belly said, "You know, I'm going to make the best of this situation that I possibly can," and he sang a song to the governor asking for an early release. And when the governor left office, he indeed did give Lead Belly an early release. Pat Neff was the name of the governor.
Uh-huh. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Detroit.
But listened to music early in your life?
You know, I listened to whatever my folks had around. You know, so they had a little bit of jazz, a little bit of blues. And then I really started to explore more, you know, when I went to college in Chicago.
What school?
University of Chicago.
Uh-huh. How did you get interested in poetry?
I was always interested in writing on some level, because I was always interested in reading on some level. Raised as kind of a bookworm. And then I probably discovered poetry when I was around 15 years old. and I slowly got a little more hip with every year. I got a little more introduced to the vagaries and the momentum of the words and the spirit of poetry. So I started writing when I was 15, and by 18 I knew that I wanted to write for a living. And then I just started. When I went to college, I actually gave it up for a little while, and then I had the fortune of meeting Sterling Plump, who was a mentor for me in Chicago, and he encouraged me to keep on writing. So I did, and then I had other, I guess, adventures in poetry, which included slam, and another life-saving field of mentors, I guess a universe of mentors that I found in an organization called Cave Canem, which is an organization of black poets that meet once a year for a week, and you can participate in this workshop where you come strictly to workshop your poems for 3 years. And I did that for 3 years, and I continue to be involved with them. And they're the people that all of that combined pushed me towards, and then getting my MFA at New York University, all of that combined gave me the energy to and gave me the ability to acknowledge hopefully what I'm put on this no definitely what I'm put on this earth for, which is to write poetry. Now, that's a long answer, I know.
Well, now your book Lead Belly just came out last year in 2005.
Yeah.
And it is your first book. Yeah. And I've asked you to read, and you've kindly agreed to read some poems from it. And before you read the first poem in that collection, let's talk a little bit about the way the book is organized and right. the language in the book. It's mm-hmm. a fascinating collection of things to me. I enjoy reading poetry, and your book is unusual in several ways, in very fascinating ways to me. The different styles of writing in it change so much. The point of view. You write from the point of view of a guitar, of a song, of different people, different characters. Sometimes you have two people kind of in conversation running down the page on two sides. I found it just visually interesting as well as wonderful writing. But what there's a problem in writing about this character in the time he lived,
right,
and with language. Talk a little bit about that problem for a writer.
Well, to step back for a minute, the book is written in it follows the life of Lead Belly in his voice and in the voices of people and objects around him,
sure,
from birth to death. So, you know, this is not just a problem that has to do with Lead Belly. It has to do with dealing with race and dealing with history, and dealing with all of the uncomfortable issues that shape our lives in this country, and the use of language. And there is some some racy, I guess, language in the book. However, there's, I guess, in this, when I read for particularly an audience like a radio,
sure,
I try to remain sensitive about what can and cannot be aired over the radio. The issues with the poems, the only two poems that I will read today, would be the use of the word nigger. And that in both the cases of the poems that I'm reading, they're being used because they were A, quotes from other people that were essential to the understanding of the racism that Lead Belly was dealing with, or the nature of the racism that Lead Belly was dealing with. And those are the basic reasons. They're quotes from other sources, one of them being an anecdote from Lead Belly, and the other one being a direct quote from John Lomax.
And we'll learn more about John Lomax in a little bit. But let's start with the first poem in this book.
This is the first poem of the book, and it's an anecdote that Lead Belly would tell later on in his life. So this is from his point of view, but then he quotes the other person that's in the book. So that's in the anecdote, excuse me. So this is entitled Lead Belly's Lessons. Mr. Haney owned Shreveport's General Store, where a dollar a week brought my 12-year-old frame's lift and lunge of barrel and crate across a sawdust floor. Still, he wanted more. See, the guitar refused to get naked with Haney. He would fumble up the seams of its hidden croon, hook, clasp, and bodice of each tune mangled down to a stunted strum. So he'd quit. He'd hoist bourbon and order me to hoist song. The velvet locomotive of marrow-deep hum I'd tote up from the swollen center of guitar, its catch and slide caught between palms and cradled across Louisiana starlight. His bottle and scowl grew louder with each reel and jump that I played while getting paid to show the way of undressing music from its wooden clothes. But it was like coaxing stone to bathe in sky. He never let his flesh wallow in the blue floating round his earth, so he buried himself deeper in his own dirt. He'd think on the hurt a white man can do without second thought. He'd slur, "Nigga, someday I'm gonna kill you," and stagger home. It was there, alone, in the dark darkness of me, that I first learned the ways of pure white envy. And thank you, Mr. Haney, for teaching me.
We've just heard the poem Lead Belly's Lessons, the first poem in a collection called Lead Belly by our poet and reader, Tayemba Jess, now a professor at the University of Illinois in it's the English Creative Writing Department.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Well, a very strong poem talking about white racism, but never uses the word, talks about white envy.
Right.
Why envy?
Right. Well, the anecdote was essentially about this white storekeeper's desire to play the guitar the way Lead Belly played it, just easily, and his desire turning into envy. He wanted to acquire the skills that Lead Belly had, and no matter how much Lead Belly tried to show him the skills, share the skills with him, the guy was inept, you know. And then he was also drinking a lot. So his desire turned into envy. That's part of the lesson in the poem, and it's also part of the lesson behind white privilege and the idea of being privileged to have a talent, the idea of having privilege and dominion over a talent such as the guitar, or even in literature, or even in whatever other endeavor, the idea that the white whoever is white and sets upon this endeavor, whatever endeavor it may be, will have more talent at that endeavor, and this is the issue, part of the issue that Lead Belly seems to deal with, and it's part of the lesson that he learns in pursuing his talent. I think that what that experience did for him was harden him up and say, I am not going to relinquish my claim over this talent, because this is one thing I can clearly do that this white person and white folks in general envy.
Now, Huddy Ledbetter who, as you mentioned, was born in 1888, right. His father gave him a guitar, and Lead Belly referred to his guitar as Stella.
Stella.
But before his father gave him a guitar the year before, in the notes you have in the back of your book on the life of Lead Belly, mm-hmm. the year before he gave him a gun.
Yeah.
Violence seemed to have been part of just what he received from his parents as well as from the setting in which he lived.
That's true. And it's you know, when we're thinking about we're thinking about 1888, and we're thinking about the area around Arkansas, Louisiana, Texas. We're really talking about the Western. You know,
the frontier.
We're living on the Western frontier, so to speak. So, and they lived on a farm. So there was, on one hand, there was a utility behind the pistol. On the other hand, it was supposed to be something that would grow him up quicker, uh-huh. and it indeed did grow him up, but not in the way that had been hoped for.
When you're reading about the life of Huddy Ledbetter and the experiences he had with music, with women, with other people, with white folks, with other people that he fought with over a woman like Shammy, mm-hmm. At mm-hmm. one point. How do you feel as a modern, well-educated person who's been to the University of Chicago and reading this? How do you as a poet relate to someone who's so different than you?
Well, you know, the fact of the matter is there are differences, but worked with is the similarities. We're both black men. We're both artists. We're both pursuing our craft. We're the best, hopefully the best way we know how. We're both dealing with, we both deal with race and gender and class and our relationship with the entities that critique and judge these phenomena throughout our lives. So there are more, the idea is to play upon the similarities more than the differences. And you know, when writing in his voice, I understand that I am not writing in the voice, in the exact words that he would speak in. But what I am trying to do is to write the thought that he would be thinking at that particular time.
I'm going to ask you to read another poem of your selection, but let me just say again, these poems are read with permission of the author, who is also reading it here in the studio, and also by permission of Verse Press, which produced this book. It is available in a lovely paperback version. I was looking for the price. Do you know how much?
It's about
$14, $15. A book well worth the price. It's called Lead Belly, and we'll ask the author Tyhimba Jess to read another selection.
Sure.
And lead us and tell us about why you choose the next poem.
Okay. The next one that I'll read. Jesus, I guess I'll read one from the perspective of Stella, who we mentioned before. Now, Stella was a Stella guitar. There was an actual brand of guitars called the Stella guitar. They were one of the first guitars to be produced. They were distributed on a national, around the country. So they were available, they were readily available, they were not the best made guitars, but they were sturdy enough for folks to make a living off of.
And so a 12-string guitar has to be pretty strong because those 12 strings will put a lot of pressure.
They do. So this is in the voice of what I would call his longtime lover, Mistress Stella Speaks. You think I'm his property, 'cause he paid cash to grab me by the neck, swing me across his knee, and stroke the living song from my hips. You think he is master of all my 12 tongues, spread notes thick as a starless night, strangling spine till my voice is a jungle of chords. The truth is that I owned him since the word love first blessed his lips, since hurt and flight and free carved their way into the cotton-fused bones of his fretting hand, since he learned how pleading men hunt for my face in the well of their throats till their tongues are soaked with want. Yes, each day he comes back home from the fields, from chain gang fury, from the smell of sometime women who borrow his body. He bends his weight around me like a wilting weed, drinking in my kiss of fretboard across fingertip till he can stand up straight again, aching from what he left behind, rising sure as dawn.
Tihemba Jess reading the poem he wrote, Mistress Stella Speaks, from the perspective of the guitar of Lead Belly, from Tihemba Jess's first award-winning book called Lead Belly. Let's think for a minute out loud about another white person that confronted Huddy Ledbetter, John Lomax, Library of Congress, anthropologist, collector of folk music. How did he find Ledbetter?
Well, Leadbelly found Lomax. They found each other when Leadbelly was in Angola prison. He was sent to Angola prison because he it was for attempted murder, to make a long story short. Lomax was, at the time, was touring around the country with a device that weighed approximately altogether about 500 pounds. It was a recording machine in the back of his his Ford coupe. And he would take this recording machine, and he would go around the South, and he would stop in plantations and on prisons. And he would ask black folks, and particularly black folks, to sing the songs that they grew up with, their work songs, their, you know, songs from the area, songs from the region, that songs that had been passed down, etc. And it was really an ingenious way of capturing what he thought, and he was probably right in thinking so, was in capturing songs that were about to be lost forever if they were not recorded. So he was capturing the oral tradition, particularly. He did it in a number of different ways, or with a number of different peoples, but he did it particularly with the African American in the South. And what he did was, he, through his adventures, through his going from plantation to prison, etc., he met this guy who knew about 500 songs. Not only did he know him by 500 songs, he could play guitar with him. Not only could he play guitar, he could, you know, he was really good at playing the guitar, and he knew him, knew these songs like the back of his hand. So it was kind of like Lomax ran into a miniature library.
Now, it sounds, the way you've said so far, that Lomax was just motivated by interest in preserving good music,
right,
and good musicians.
Right.
But in one of Lomax's letters back to his wife that you quote in one of your poems,
right,
he says, I'm going to get this back to New York and copyright it.
Right, and was he
ripping off?
He was exploiting. He was, through his research, through his, you know, anthropological research, on one hand, it was also kind of a hustle on the other hand.
Uh-huh.
So he was indeed planning to take these songs and copyright them in his own name and make as much money out of them as he possibly could. As a matter of fact, a story that I couldn't get into the book was when Lead Belly sued Lomax before the publication of a book of Lead Belly songs. And the situation got so hung up with the publishing company that Lomax had to get a settlement, a small settlement, but a settlement with Lead Belly before the book could be published. But but throughout their time together, Lomax had his eye constantly on not just on the preservation of these songs, but also on profiting from the preservation of the songs without a fair compensation towards the artist.
Is there a poem from your book that would deal with some of these issues you'd care to read?
Yes. We have time before the break?
We do.
Okay, good. So, 'cause this poem is what I call a double-jointed poem, okay? This is a poem, if your audience can just imagine for a minute, there's a poem with a split right down the middle, okay? On either side of the poem is text. And on one side of the split is the voice of John Lomax. And in this particular poem, it is an excerpt directly from a letter that he sent home to his wife in 1934. And it's in italics. On the other side is the voice of Lead Belly. And it's the imagined voice of what he would be writing home to his wife. So this poem reads down one side and then down the other side. And then it also reads across in order to create one voice out of the two voices. So I'm going to read down one side and then in Lomax, then down the other side in Lead Belly's, and then I'm going to read across, okay?
Great.
Okay, cool. So this is Lomax versus Lead Belly in New York, Letters to Home, 1934. This is when they had both gone, after Lead Belly had gotten out of jail, they traveled up north, and they eventually ended up in New York. And this is, the two had differences. Lomax. I am disturbed and distressed at his beginning to show off in his songs and talk when his money value is to be natural and sincere as he was while in prison. Of course, as this tendency grows, he will lose his charm and become only an ordinary, low ordinary Harlem nigger. Lead Belly's letter to his wife. This man messing with my music, preaching how a songster gotta be pure, like he got a deed to folk ways, the way blues sweats out a man, like prayer set free from smothering in a solitary cell. Fact is, this two-time jailbird loser, he ain't bout to lose nerve too, and become only an old-timey, busted-out, countrified nigger. And so now the two voices combined. I am disturbed and distressed at this man messing with my music. His beginning to show off, preaching how a songster gotta be pure in his songs and talk like he got a deed to folk ways. When his money value is the way blues sweats out a man, to be like prayer, natural and sincere, set free from smothering as he was while in prison in a solitary cell. Of course, fact is, as this tendency grows, this two-time jailbird loser, he will lose his charm. He ain't bout to lose nerve, too, and become only an ordinary, old-timey, low-ordinary, busted-out, Harlem-countrified nigger.
Lomax versus Lead Belly, 1934.
Yes.
Read and written by our guest today in the studio, Tahimba Jess, the author of the collection Lead Belly, that came out just last year. So this form of a poem, had you ever run across a poem like that before?
I've run across poems similar to it, but I've never run across one that did exactly the things that this particular poem is doing.
You have several in this collection like that.
It's fascinating. About eight of them.
Fascinating to read. And as a reader, I wasn't sure how to read them. It was clear I could read down one side and get one voice and down the other. And then I noticed that, oh, yeah, each line is carefully composed so it can also show contrast or similarity or shock together. So I did manage to figure out how to read it that way, too.
Okay.
But thank you for
that. That was the whole point.
Right.
Well, my mother told me I was supposed to put a note in it, but I told her I couldn't do that.
Well, it's interesting the notes you do choose to put in that are helpful, that give sort of the life of Lead Belly, and as well as the notes on some poems where you kind of have footnotes, but you don't tell people they're there until you maybe find them at the end. So they're helpful when you find them, but not necessary.
Right.
We are about halfway through our program, and let me tell listeners that, yes, this is a live program, and yes, I will eventually let you in, but I'm enjoying so much hearing our poet read today, I've put off encouraging listeners to call until now. But in the second half of the program, we will let listeners ask questions and make comments for our guest that's here in the studio. I'll be giving those numbers in just a moment. You are listening to Keeping the Faith. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for this program. This is every Sunday from 5 to 6 here on AM 580, WILL, a radio service of the College of Communications here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. This program is supported in part by the University YMCA, where I'm the executive director. The Y is the oldest continuous student recognized organization at the university. It was founded in 1873 and has been active on this campus ever since, helping students be involved in social action and community service and learning and education outside of the classroom, particularly service learning. One of the ways the Y supports itself, in addition to donations from people who are interested in its continued mission, is we do sponsor something called Dump and Run. And for the next 3 days, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, folks in the community can donate household items that students would find helpful when they come to campus in another week. And if you'd bring any items you have, furniture, household goods, clothes, just almost anything, to the Stock Pavilion on Pennsylvania Avenue, Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday of this week, that's August 14, 15, or 16, anytime in the afternoon from 12 until 7 each of those days, we'll be very grateful. Anything you have in your attic or your garage or your basement that you're not using that might be useful to someone else, particularly international students who come to this country or come to this university literally by the thousands this time of year, they often come with two suitcases and face an empty apartment, perhaps in Orchard Downs or elsewhere. So all kinds of things are needed. Things that you donate, we sell very cheaply so that students get a bargain. The Y makes a little bit of money to survive, and it also keeps things out of the waste stream. So things that you might consider trash may be a treasure to students, so Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday from 12 to 7. Do bring them to the Stock Pavilion on Pennsylvania Avenue. That's just a couple blocks east of Memorial Stadium on Pennsylvania Avenue. If you have questions, call the Y, 337-1500. We much prefer you to bring it to us, but if there's no other way to get it, do give us a call, and we'll try to arrange to pick things up. Our sale, for those who are listening who might be coming to school here, and it's also open to the public, the sale itself is August 24, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. On August 24, we'll start at 2 in the afternoon and go till 9 on Thursday, on Friday from 10 to 6, and on Saturday from 9 to 12. And then nonprofit groups in the community can come and get things that are still left, and many good things will still be left at noon. And at 1 o'clock, we'll start giving things away free on that Saturday, August 26. That'll be the sale. But bring items the next 3 days, please. Well, let me give the numbers so the listeners who would like to talk to our poet in residence here for this hour, Taihim Bajess, anywhere the program is heard, you can punch in 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. In Champaign-Urbana, there are three local lines you can reach by punching in 333-9455. And I see we already have a caller. Let's go to line number one.
Professor Majeff, Jim in Urbana. I'd like you to take up the question of Leadbelly's Hughie Leadbetter relationship to Pete Seeger, Woody Guthrie, and I suppose to some extent the Communist Party. And I'm not red baiting you here because I was very close to the CP in the 60s, and to some extent I still am. But his Bourgeois Blues is a very interesting song about Washington. And what do you know about that? And thank you very much for taking my call.
Thanks.
And before our guest responds, let me just spell his last name. It's J-E-S-S, and the first name is Tyhimba, spelled T-Y-E-H-I-M-B-A.
Thanks.
Professor Jess. Yes.
Thanks a lot. He had a very close relationship with Pete Seeger. When he moved back to New York, first he went to New York with John Lomax. And then John Lomax and him fell apart, and he went back to Louisiana for a minute. And then he moved back to New York, and he started a relatively, not lucrative, but a successful career performing. And Pete Seeger was one of the folks who used to hang out with him. Sonny Terry, Brownie McGee, Lightnin' Hopkins, everybody would come over his apartment in Harlem, and they would hang out. There were quite a few gigs that he would do with the Communist Party at the time. You know, this is the late 40s, mid to late 40s, and it was a time of organizing and using the songs to help organize. And Leadbelly was ready and available to do so. I wouldn't feel safe making a how should I say it. I wouldn't say that he particularly that he was an advocate, so to speak, of the Communist Party, so to speak. But I think that he saw them as fellow travelers, and he did gigs with them. And they were open to his music, and he was open to people who were open to his music. Yeah.
And the Communist Party at that time was concerned with some of the same issues that he'd faced in his life.
That's true.
So the FBI, you report in your book in the notes at one point, or maybe it's the biographical outline, at one time was investigating Leadbelly.
Yeah, they had him under investigation and under a certain degree of surveillance. Hmm. So they had so many people on, and still do have so many people under surveillance. So I think that he was really, I just get the impression from reading about his life that when he was in New York, he wanted to spread his voice around as much as he possibly could. Mm-hmm. And the folks that worked with the CPUSA were especially amenable to hearing his voice. And it worked out really well in terms of their relationship.
Let's go to another caller, and then I'll ask you to read another poem of your selection from your book, Leadbelly. Let's go to line number two. Yes.
Professor Jess, I wanted to tell you that I really liked the poem about the guitar. And I wanted to ask you what textbook you use in your creative writing class.
Whoa. What textbook do I use in my creative writing class? I usually try and use other people's poetry books in my creative writing class. So I can give you a long list. Van Jorten's Magnolia, Marie Howe's, some of Marie Howe's work, Sonia Sanchez, some Sharon Olds, who else? Natasha Trethewey, Patricia Smith, Camille Dungy. I hope you're getting all these names down. But it's the thing, I usually try and work directly with other poets' work and set upon the task of examining their work and seeing how it reflects with the students' lives, and so that they can be exposed to actual living poets who are still working in creating contemporary work, and then using that as a bridge to the poets that have passed before.
Thank you.
Thank you for your question. Have you read another one of your one of your poems from Lead Belly, and let me say again, we're talking with Tahimba Jess, J-E-S-S, mm-hmm. who is the author of the book that came out just last year about the life and career of Lead Belly, the 12-string guitarist who you described as a folk musician, sometimes thought of as a blues musician. You mentioned before you read, the Weavers recorded right. after Lead Belly's death, yes. Goodnight Irene, and there's yeah. some question about whether he wrote that song or whether it was a traditional song that he just made popular or added to or whatever, but
right.
but it became a huge hit for the
huge
Weavers.
Hit. It yeah. was a huge hit.
Yeah.
The Weavers released that within about 10 or 11 months after he died.
Huh.
And it became a mega, mega hit. And I guess what I'll do is I'd like to read one poem from the voice of the woman who became his wife and who kind of snuck her way, barged her way into the manuscript. And then I'll comment on that a little
fine,
bit more
fine.
Later. But I would like to read this one because this is from the voice of Martha Promise, who was 17 years older, I mean younger than him, 17 years younger than him, and was a laundress who lived in Shreveport, who was hooking up with a guy who was older, out of work, and a two-time convict. So I had to
And married.
And, he wasn't married.
Oh, he wasn't.
He wasn't married.
Okay.
He wasn't married.
No, I'm not remembering it correctly.
Right.
Sorry.
Martha Promise receives Lead Belly, 1935. When your man comes home from prison, when he comes back like the wound and you are the stitch, when he comes back with pennies in his pocket and prayer fresh on his lips, you got to wash him down first. You got to have the wild weed and tree bark boiled and calmed, waiting for his skin like a shining baptism back into what he was before gun barrels and bars chewed their claim in his hide and spit him stumbling backwards into screaming sunlight. You got to scrub loose the jail time finger smears from ashy skin. Lather down the cuff marks from ankle and wrist. Rinse solitary's stench loose from his hair. Scrape curse and confession from the welted and the smooth, the hard and the soft, the furrowed and the lax. You got to hold tight that Shadrach's face between your palms. Take crease and lid and lip and brow and rinse slow with river water. And when he opens his eyes, you tell him, calm and sure, how a woman birthed him back whole again.
A poem from the voice of Martha Promise, 1935, talking about her relationship with Lead Belly, imagined by our poet Tahimba Jess from his collection Lead Belly, published last year and read by permission of the author. Let's talk about women and Lead Belly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because he got in a fight over a woman.
Right, he got in a fight over a woman when he was, he must have been 19 years old. And he shot a man in the head. And of course he died. And that set him upon a course towards prison. And he had somewhat violent relationships with women. And I found that to be one aspect of his life that was particularly troubling, but it was impossible to ignore. So I, in the course of the book, I do make an effort to address those relationships and hit there how those relationships perhaps saw violence and how they were revisited time and time again upon him. So I guess I can read one of those poems right now.
Sure.
I think.
While you're looking for that, I'm looking through my book. While you're looking for that poem, let me just remind listeners, this is Keeping the Faith here on WILL, and we're talking with Tihemba Jess, poet and professor at the University of Illinois in the Creative Writing Department. Mm-hmm. And he's participated in, among other things, poetry slams, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But one of the reasons I think you read so effectively is the those kind of almost competitive poetry events where how you read or recite a poem is,
makes a big difference.
Makes a big difference. So.
Yeah, in a slam, you pretty much have to. In the slam, you pretty much have to go all out. And read as inventively as you think the text will be able to bear, and that is kind of what happens when it kind of translates into your reading beyond the slam. So I'll read this one. This one is entitled the name of the. One of the women that he had, that he was with before he was married, was Era. So this is Loving Era. How do I explain it? I come home with my fat curved guitar, holding all the voices of all the women from juke to juke, and somehow this woman taste through my gin and whiskey smile to find honeysuckle kiss of whores on my lips. Seizes the neck of my Stella, smashes the give and bend of her body to floor. The room pinwheels strong as a fully swung black Annie belt. Hell tilts up the floorboards, balance is pushed blind into a riot of broken string and slatted wood, all my women's notes spreading their ochre and indigo to Texas dawn. And now this rock that is my fist, that is my living, that is my hand, that blurs against her temple a black to brown hammerfall that nails her skull into scream. This is how we love. This is the song she teaches me each time I wander back to her door.
Another of his poems from his collection Lead Belly, read by the author Tihemba Jess. For listeners who may have tuned in late and not known what the Stella was, it was referred to in that poem, that is the type of guitar he played, and he called his guitar Stella. And if you'd like to hear the first part of this program, and perhaps you've missed it, it will be archived online. And so if you go to your computer and punch in WILL.UIUC.edu and then go to AM 580 and then Keeping the Faith, you will find this program. It'll be up in about 2 weeks. It'll be there for years to come. So if you'd like to hear this program again or hear the first part of it, do go online to that address, WILL.UIUC.edu, and then AM 580, and Keeping the Faith. A listener called and asked if we would play some music by Lead Belly, and that would have been a good thing to do perhaps, but I wanted to focus mainly on the poetry of our guest today, but this might encourage you to go to your local store or online and find some of Lead Belly's music. How much of his music did you listen to as you were writing these poems? Was that
part of the stimulus
for it?
Yeah, definitely.
We have another caller waiting on line number one. You're on the air.
Yes. Two questions. I haven't read this book, but does a poet have to have a quiet mind? It sounds like he's very violent sometimes. Or what time of day or night is it written? The logistics of writing is the question. And I'll hang up and listen to your answer off the air. Thanks.
So when do you write, and do you have to have a quiet mind, or do you live a very active life?
Well, I think the words you used was violent, right?
Yeah.
I'm a pretty peaceful cat. I don't know about the quiet mind. I think that the question is focus. You know, that's the major issue. And you can focus where it for every person, it's different. You can may have great focus early in the morning. I write rather well sometimes in coffee shops.
Huh.
So I have the ability to, somehow something about coffee shops makes me focus.
Since this show deals with issues of ethics and values as well as spirituality and religion, I noticed in reading your collection that there are several references to themes or characters from the Bible. For example, you just, in the poem, one of the poems you read referred to Shadrach. Another one refers to Lazarus.
Right.
Did the Christian faith have anything to do with the life of Ledbetter?
You know, I think that it did. He considered himself a Christian. He considered himself to be, he wasn't necessarily a church going kind of guy, but you know, he was raised Christian. And I think the thing about his life, in bringing the Bible into the text, or acknowledging the presence of the Bible and the characters from the Bible in the text, it helped me enrich my vision of where Leadbelly was coming from. You know, I was raised Christian, Catholic, actually. Uh-huh. But it was a challenge for me because I generally don't try to deal with, in the rest of my writing, I generally don't deal with religion very much.
Uh-huh.
So it was a challenge and a learning experience bringing those characters and using them in the ways that I was called to use them.
Earlier today on the station as well as nationally, there was a program dealing with the whole issue of black males in America today. You deal with those themes throughout this book, using Leadbelly's life and experience as a way partially to look at the kind of pressures and stresses that are on black males. When I was listening earlier, Cornel West was one of the panelists, and as he was speaking, he was talking about the kind of importance education played.
Yeah.
Now Leadbelly didn't have the advantage of an education.
No, he had
not
a very,
in schools.
Very limited education, uh-huh. Right? Although he had the education of when he considered his school to be the streets of Shreveport and the people that he would work with musically.
Sure.
That was what he considered his education.
We have a couple callers waiting. Right. Let's try to sneak him in our last couple minutes. Line number four, you're on the air. Go right ahead.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes. I was wondering if the author could or the poet could tell us why he writes, and is it because he has to write, or, you know, what his inspiration or his muses, or does he write every day even if he doesn't feel like writing, or does he wait till something happens and he says, I feel like writing something?
I try to write every day. I write to keep my sanity, and I've had a lot of jobs where I wasn't allowed to write very well, and this being here at the university is a way that I can constantly scratch that itch. So write whenever you possibly can.
And we have another caller on line one. Go right ahead. Line number one.
All right.
Well, we have a listener
who takes it to heart.
Absolutely, brought us some Lead Belly right through the telephone.
Can't say it any better than that.
Listener, did you want to make a comment as well?
That's his comment.
Okay.
All right.
Well, we're down to our last, literally last few seconds with our guest Ahimba Jess. Any last words on Lead Belly for our listeners?
Well. All I can say is I hope that you enjoy the book if you do get it.
Well, I certainly did, and it's one that bears reading and rereading. It's a very rich book, and we didn't get around to one of my biggest questions I've been wanting to ask, which is you close with a sonnet sequence, six sonnets, interspersed with other things.
Right.
This very traditional English poetry form.
I felt like it's a crown of sonnets.
It
I felt
is,
like
yeah.
the king of the 12 string needed a crown.
Wow. Perfect. Well, I'll leave that for our listeners to discover at the end of this book, which is called Lead Belly, published last year by Verse Press and available in your bookstores for about $15 in a lovely paperback. Well, thanks to our guest and to our callers next week on Keeping the Faith. We'll be talking about nuclear issues with Alice Hurt and David Kraft. By phone, our guest the following week will be Mike Kozer talking about Communiversity. Tim Holder will be talking about a hip-hop e-mass. He's rector of Trinity Episcopal Church in the South Bronx in New York City. And Father Holder will be talking about the use of hip-hop in worship. Reverend Ignacio Costuera, who's the national chaplain for Planned Parenthood, will be our guest. Live in studio on September 17th. Elihu Smith will be talking about hateful, violent religions on September 24. Those are some of the programs coming up on Keeping the Faith. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for the program, and let me remind listeners again, bring items that students could use to the Stock Pavilion at the University on Pennsylvania Avenue Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday afternoon. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
Thanks for having me on.
Glad to have you here.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, a production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
June 22, 1977. Two college women are camping. A man runs over their tent in a pickup truck and then attacks the women with an axe. 15 years later, one of the women returns to Central Oregon to try to solve the crime. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time, on To the Best of Our Knowledge, Terry Gents shares her story. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana.
Next time on the Afternoon Magazine, a special talk to the manager. WILL General Manager Mark Leonard will be our guest. Leonard, who succeeded Don Mullally earlier this year, oversees WILL AM and FM and WILL TV. I'm Celeste Quinn. I'll invite your questions and comments about the WILL stations for Mark Leonard following the 1 o'clock news. The Afternoon Magazine begins at noon, Monday through Friday, here on AM 580 WILL Urbana.